This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. Chapter 37. I came to know many views of the world and life during my Weimar period. In part, this was because I had constant direct contact with those who discussed those matters, and also because in those days many who were interested in just this kind of conversation passed through Weimar. I was at an age when the inclination is to turn intensively toward one's environment, trying to establish a firm relationship with outer life. For me, the various views and philosophies were a bit of the external world. I began to realize how little I had truly participated in the world up to that point. Whenever I withdrew from active social life, I became aware, particularly at that time, that in fact the only world I had been familiar with so far was the spiritual world I witnessed inwardly. I found it easy to connect with that world. I also began to realize how very difficult it had been for me during childhood and youth to relate to the outer world through the senses. I had always found it difficult to commit to memory external facts that had to be assimilated, for example, in studying science. I had to observe natural objects repeatedly so that I could identify them and know their scientific classification. To me, the external world really appeared somewhat shadowy, or like images. It moved past me like pictures, whereas the connection with the spiritual always had the character of concrete reality. I felt this especially during the early 1890s in Weimar, while I was adding the final touches to my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, A Philosophy of Freedom. Writing that book, I felt I was writing out thoughts handed to me by the spiritual world until my 30th year. What I received from the external world, on the other hand, was experienced merely as a stimulus. I experienced that stimulus in particular when I shared in the lively discussions in Weimar about world views. I had to go into the feelings and ways of thinking of others, but they did not penetrate the meaning of my own inner life. I lived intensively with what others saw and thought, but I could not allow the spiritual reality within me to flow into what I experienced in that way. My core being had to remain always within myself. My inner world was truly separated from the outer world, as if by a thin wall. Thus I lived, inwardly, in a world that bordered the outer world, but I always had to cross a threshold when I wanted to interact with the outer world. I took part in the liveliest discussions, but each time I had to enter them through a door, so to speak. As a result, I felt as though I was merely visiting whenever I participated in the outer world. But that did not prevent me from devoting my interest to whomever or whatever I was visiting. Indeed, I felt very much at home while on such visits. I experienced both people and worldviews in this way. I enjoyed, quote-unquote, visiting Suffan and Hartleben. Suffan never went to Hartleben, nor Hartleben to Suffan. Neither could go into the thoughts and feelings of the other, but I felt immediately at home with either. But neither Suffan nor Hartleben ever visited me. When they came, they remained in their own worlds. I never experienced visits in my spiritual world. My soul witnessed many various worldviews, those based on science as well as those based on idealism, and many shades between. I felt a need to enter them all, to be oriented in them. They did not really illuminate my spiritual world, but were phenomena I encountered, not realities that I could grow into. This was the condition of my soul as I came into direct contact with worldviews such as those of Haeckel and Nietzsche. I sensed their relative justification. Because of my soul mood, it was impossible for me to say that one is right or the other wrong. I would have had to sense that what lived in them was alien to me. But one did not feel more alien than the other. While I could feel at home in any world view, I was truly at home only in the spiritual world I directly perceived. When described in this way, It may seem as if everything was essentially a matter of indifference to me, but that was not the case at all. I experienced something entirely different. The reason I could participate fully in the views of others was that I did not alienate myself from them by judging them immediately in terms of my own views and feelings. For example, I had countless conversations with Otto Harnack, the gifted author of title Goethe at the Height of His Development. At the time, he frequented Weimar, because he was working on Goethe's writings on art. I liked that man, who later in life encountered a shattering tragedy. When I spoke with him, I was able to become completely Otto Harnack. I entered his thoughts and felt that I was on a visit, as I described. Nevertheless, I felt as though I was at home. It never occurred to me to invite him to visit me. I saw that he could live only within his own thoughts. He was so enmeshed in his own thoughts that he experienced any thoughts that were not his own as alien. He would have been able to approach my inner world only in a Kantian sense, as the, quote, thing as such, beyond consciousness, unquote. I felt it was my spiritual duty not to treat his world in the Kantian sense, but to lead consciousness into it. Obviously, I did not live without spiritual dangers and difficulties. Those who dismiss whatever fails to accord with their own personal thinking feel no need to bother with a relative justification of the many various worldviews. They can, without reservation, allow themselves to be enchanted by whatever is thought out in a particular way. This charm of the intellect is very widespread, and people quickly dispense with those thoughts that differ from their own. But those who experience the spiritual world through direct perception, as it must be, can see the validity even in widely differing perspectives. They always avoid becoming too inclined toward one or the other. When, however, one can focus with loving interest on the external world, one soon becomes conscious of its true nature, although one must always return to the inner world of the spirit. This also teaches one to live truly in the spirit. The various intellectual perspectives reject one another, but spiritual perception sees them merely as standpoints, each of which provide a different view of the world. It is like photographing a house from various sides. The images are different, but the house is the same. When one walks around the actual house, a complete impression is obtained. If one stands truly within the spiritual world, one accepts the validity of whatever is correct in any standpoint. One regards a photograph as something correct from one perspective and then considers the validity and significance of that standpoint. I had to approach both Nietzsche and Haeckel this way. I felt that Nietzsche had photographed the world from the perspective he was forced into as a late 19th-century person of great depth, as one living only in the spiritual nature of that age, one for whom spiritual perception did not wish to become conscious, and whose subconscious will nevertheless press toward the spirit with immense forces. This image of Nietzsche lived in my soul. It showed me one who did not see spirit, but one in whom the spirit subconsciously battled the unspiritual nature of the time. The end of chapter 37. Chapter 38. A branch of the Society for Ethical Culture, which had been founded in America, was being established in Germany at that time. It seems natural that in our materialistic age, such an impulse to deepen ethical life would be welcomed, but its fundamental philosophy aroused serious doubts in me. The movement's leaders claimed that in our time we face many contradictory views of life and the world, as well as of knowledge, religion, and social feelings. It is impossible for people to agree on such matters. And it is wrong when the moral feelings we should have toward one another are drawn into the realm of those opposing views. It does no good when people let differences of opinion over religion, social issues, and philosophy influence their moral behavior toward those who think and feel differently. We must find principles that are fundamental to a pure human ethics, fully independent of all worldviews and acceptable to everyone, irrespective of the ideas people have about the various aspects of life. The Society for Ethical Culture made a deep impression on me and touched my most important views. I saw an abyss in modern thinking between natural phenomena and spiritual and morally universal meaning. People view nature in such a way that they must depict world evolution without spiritual and moral meaning. Their thinking is hypothetical, picturing a purely material, primordial state of the universe. They try to discover laws to explain how beings endowed with life, soul, and spirit gradually evolved to their present condition from that primordial state. I saw clearly that if this trend of thinking is carried to its logical consequence, the spiritual and moral element will be seen as no more than the product of natural processes. This would mean that natural phenomena, though indifferent to spirit and morality, actually create morality as a kind of byproduct of evolution, and ultimately bury it again under moral indifference. I realized, however, that careful thinkers would not reach this conclusion. They had simply accepted what natural phenomena seemed to say, and reserved judgment concerning the significance of spiritual morality within the larger scheme of things. But this was beside the point. It seemed unimportant to say that in terms of natural phenomena, one must maintain an indifference toward morality, and that to think along these lines is, in any case, merely to theorize. Each of us must form our own thinking about morality. To me, the most important point was this. It is impossible to attribute self-dependent, self-sustaining reality to spiritual morality, while nature, right down to the smallest detail, is viewed in such a conventional way. If physics, chemistry, and biology continue to be considered unassailable in this way, then the entities thought of as reality absorb all reality into themselves, and spiritual morality will be only foam arising from that reality. I saw into a different reality, one that is spiritual and moral, and at the same time natural. To me, it seemed to be a weakness of one's effort toward knowledge to be unwilling to penetrate this reality. According to my worldview, which acknowledges spirit, an all-embracing reality exists that reveals itself as moral beyond the realm of natural processes and spiritual morality. It also has the force to transform itself into a process that becomes just as valid as any natural process. Natural processes seem indifferent toward spiritual morality, simply because they have fallen from their original unity with the other, just as a human corpse becomes severed from the living soul and spirit of the human being. I was certain of this, because it was not something merely contrived in my mind. I saw that it is the reality of cosmic spiritual facts and beings. The ethicists that I described seemed to consider such knowledge unimportant. They were convinced, more or less unconsciously, that all philosophic effort leads nowhere, that it would be better to rescue some ethical principles from philosophy that require no investigation into their cosmic origin. I saw that such complete despair over all philosophy expressed the symptoms of those times. I saw it as frivolous, even lacking consciousness, to assert that we should just drop all philosophy so that morality will again spread among people. On many walks through the parks of Weimar with Hans and Greta Olden, I expressed myself vehemently about such superficiality. I insisted that if people deepen their views of the world as much as their capacities allow, they will discover a cosmic process that gives rise to morality as reality, just as much as it does to nature. I wrote a strong article for a periodical titled The Future, which had recently been established. In it I spoke out against what I described as ethics completely separated from reality, which is consequently powerless. The article drew a very unfriendly response, and it could hardly have been otherwise. The ethicists viewed themselves as the saviors of our civilization. This issue was extremely important to me. I wanted to fight for an essential issue, the validity of a worldview that sees the realm of ethics as having an equal standing in reality with that of any other aspect. I had to fight this ethics with no philosophical foundation. I went from Weimar to Berlin in search of opportunities to express my views through the press. I called on Hermann Grimm, a man I greatly admired, who had received me with the greatest friendliness. But it seemed peculiar to Grimm that I should bother him with the enthusiasm for my cause that filled me. He listened without much interest as I told him my views about the ethicists. I thought I could interest him in an issue that was so very important to me. I got nowhere. And when he heard I wanted to do something, he said, "Why don't you go and see them? I know most of them. They are really very nice people." I felt as though cold water had been thrown over me. The man I respected so much had absolutely no sense of what I wanted. He thought I would think more sensibly about the matter if I could be reassured by meeting those ethicists and see that they were all nice people. I found no more interest in others than I had in Grimm. This is the way it was for me in those days. I had to come to terms entirely on my own with everything related to my spiritual perception. I lived in the spiritual world. Not one of all those I knew followed me there. My social interactions involved visits to the world of others. Nevertheless, I loved those excursions. My respect for Grimm was not harmed in the least. I received a good training in the art of lovingly entering with understanding whatever interested others, who nevertheless did not attempt to understand what deeply concerned me. This was the nature of my loneliness in Weimar, where I led an active social life. I did not hold it against others that they sentenced me in this way to loneliness. In fact, I saw that many of them felt a deep unconscious need for a philosophy that could get to the roots of existence. I sensed that many of them were troubled by conventional thinking, which appeared reliable merely because it was concerned only with the obvious. To such thinking, nature is the whole world, and it believed that there was no other option and that one had to view this as the correct way of thinking. And consequently, any feelings that might arise in the soul to suggest otherwise were suppressed. This clarified many things in my spiritual environment. This was when I gave my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, its final form, the substance of which had lived within me for a long time. The end of chapter 38. Chapter 39. As soon as it was published, I sent a copy of my book to Edward von Hartmann. He read it very attentively. I soon received that copy back, its margins filled from beginning to end with his detailed comments. He also wrote to me that, among other things, the title should be titled Epistemological Phenomenalism and Ethical Individualism. He understood neither the source of my ideas nor my goal. He thought of the sensory world in a modified Kantian way. He considered our sensory world to be the product of an essential reality that affects the human soul through the senses. In his view, that reality never enters the realm of our conscious experience, but has to remain beyond the reach of consciousness. Only through logical conclusions can one build up hypothetical mental images about it. Thus, the sensory world is not viewed as an objective reality. It is still nothing but a subjective manifestation, whose only existence is within the soul for as long as the latter encompasses it with consciousness. I tried to show in my book that there is nothing unknown behind the sensory world, but that within the sensory world is the spiritual world, and I tried to make it clear that the realm of human ideas exists within that spiritual world. Therefore, the true reality of the sensory realm remains hidden from human consciousness only to the extent that the soul's perception is limited to the senses. When the experience of ideas is added to sensory perception, consciousness experiences the sensory world as objective reality. Cognition does not portray some substantiality. To cognize involves embracing that entity with the soul. To advance from the not as yet essential, to advance from the not yet essential aspect of the sensory world to its essential reality is a step that takes place within consciousness. Thus the sensory world is appearance, or phenomenon, only to the degree that consciousness has not yet mastered it. The sensory world is, in fact, the spiritual world, and the human soul lives within that known spiritual world by broadening its consciousness to embrace it. The goal of cognition, or knowing, is to consciously experience the spiritual realm in the visible presence of which everything ultimately dissolves into spirit. I presented spiritual reality as an alternative to phenomenalism. Von Hartmann thought that my intention was to remain with phenomena and simply abandon any conclusions drawn from them in terms of objective reality. My thinking appeared to him as a condemnation of human consciousness that would keep it from any reality at all, causing it to move forever in a world of appearances that exists only as mental images in the soul, as phenomena. Consequently, my search for the spirit through a widening of consciousness was placed in opposition to the view that spirit is found primarily only in the human imagination and otherwise can merely be conceptualized. This was essentially the view of the time, into which I introduced title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. That view had constricted all experience of spirit to an experience of human mental representations, and from there no path could be found to a real objective world of spirit. I wanted to show how within the subjective experience of mental pictures, objective spirit shines forth and becomes the true substance of consciousness. Edward von Hartmann held it against me that I explained matters in such a way that I remained stuck in the appearances of the sensory perceptible, that I neglected to mention objective reality at all. Consequently, it was inevitable that von Hartmann would find my ethical individualism questionable. After all, what is the foundation of ethical individualism in my philosophy of freedom? It involves the fact that I saw the soul's center as completely united with the world of spirit. I tried to present matters so that what seemed to be a disturbing difficulty for many would resolve itself. In other words, people had the view that in order to know, the soul, or the capital I, must differentiate itself from what it cognizes, and therefore it cannot unite with it. Nevertheless, such differentiation is possible as well when the soul swings like a pendulum, so to speak, back and forth between self-reflection and at-oneness with the spiritual reality. The soul becomes unconscious as it penetrates objective spirit, but in self-reflection it takes the complete essence into consciousness. Thus, because the personal, individual human I can penetrate the world's spiritual reality, it can also experience the moral impulses within that reality. Morality receives meaning that manifests out of the spiritual world within a human individuality. One's consciousness, now expanded into the spiritual, directly perceives what is revealed as a result. A human being is motivated to moral action by experiencing the world of spirit when that world is revealed in the soul. Such an experience takes place within the personal human individuality. When we experience ourselves by interacting with the spiritual world through a moral action, we experience freedom. The spiritual realm does not compel, but acts in such a way that we ourselves must develop activity that impels us to embrace spirit. One goal of title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path was to show that in truth the sensory world is spiritual, and that the human being as a soul being lives and weaves in spirit reality by apprehending the truth of the sensory realm. Another goal was to demonstrate that the moral realm is a sphere that is approached in freedom, because its existence shines for us when we experience the spiritual world with awareness. Consequently, human moral nature must be sought through an entirely individual and conscious union with the ethical impulses of the spiritual world. I experienced both parts of titled intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, as a spiritual organism, as a true unity, whereas Edward von Hartmann saw one as epistemological phenomenalism and labeled the other ethical individualism. My soul mood at the time determined the form of the book's ideas. Through direct experience and perception of the spiritual world, the sensory world was revealed to me as spiritual, and I wanted to create a natural science that acknowledges spirit. Through direct perception of self-knowledge of the human soul, the moral world lights up within the soul as completely individual experience. Spiritual experience is the source of the way I formed the ideas of my book. The book represents primarily an anthroposophy oriented toward nature and toward human beings within nature as entirely individual moral beings. In a way, titled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path freed me of what destiny had demanded of me in terms of forming ideas during the first chapter of my life and placed them into the external world. This took place through my experience of the natural scientific mysteries of existence. My next task could only be a struggle to form ideas of the spirit world itself. In my book, I characterize the knowledge we receive from outside through sensory observation as the inner anthroposophical experience of spirit in the human mind. I did not yet use the term anthroposophy because my initial tendency was always to formulate ideas instead of terminology. Now I faced the task of formulating ideas that would present the human soul's experience of the spiritual world itself. My life between the ages of 30 and 40 was filled with an intense inner struggle for those ideas. During the greater portion of that period, it was my destiny to be busy outwardly with matters that were unrelated to my inner life, so that the latter could not find expression. The end of chapter 39. Chapter 40. At this time I joined the group concerned with the spiritual experiences of Nietzsche. My first encounter with Nietzsche's writings was in 1889. Before that time, I had not read a single line of his work. Nietzsche's views did not in any way influence my ideas as expressed in titled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom. I was drawn to his style because of his relationship to life. I sensed that he was a person who was compelled by disposition and education to live intensely within the cultural and spiritual life around him. But he was also one who might say, quote, "What does all of this life have to do with me? I find so much of it repugnant. There must be another world where I can live." Unquote. This is the kind of feeling that made Nietzsche such a fiery critic of his time, but one that made him ill by means of his own criticism. He had to experience illness and only dream of his own health. Initially, he looked for a way to make his dream of health the substance of his life. Like Wagner, Schopenhauer, and the modern positivists, he tried to dream in order to make his dream real in his soul. The day arrived, however, when he realized that it was merely a dream. Then, with all the power of his spirit, he tried to find true reality, one that must exist somewhere. But he found no path to that reality, only a longing that became his reality. As he dreamed, the powerful force of his soul turned those dreams into a reality within him. That reality was unfettered by the earthbound quality that had characterized human ideas for so long. He experienced spiritual release, but it was adversely affected by the zeitgeist. This is how I experienced Nietzsche through his writing. I was fascinated by the free-sailing levity of his ideas, and I found that his free-floating had caused many ideas to develop in him that were like those I experienced, though attained along a very different path. Because of this kinship, in 1895 I could write in the foreword to my book titled Friedrich Nietzsche, Fighter for Freedom, quote, "As early as 1886 in my book titled A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception, The reader will find that I express the same sort of convictions as those expressed by Nietzsche in some of his works." Unquote. What particularly attracted me about Nietzsche was that the reader never felt as though persuaded to become a follower. One could enjoy the light of his spirit without feeling obligated. Indeed, one felt that his words began to laugh if one ascribed to them the need to agree, whereas assent is presupposed by writers such as Haeckel or Spencer. My affinity with Nietzsche allowed me to describe in my book about him my relationship to him in the very words he uses to describe his relationship to Schopenhauer. Quote, "I am among those readers of Nietzsche who, once they read a page, know absolutely that they will read every page and listen to every word he has ever spoken. I felt immediate confidence in him. I understood him as though he had written in place of me, to clearly express me, though with presumption and foolishness." End quote. One day, as I was about to begin writing my book on Nietzsche, Elisabeth Förster Nietzsche, his sister, appeared at the Goethe Schiller Archives. She was about to take the preliminary steps in founding the Nietzsche Archives and wanted to know about the Goethe Schiller how the Goethe Schiller Archives were arranged. Soon after that, I also met Fritz Kögel when he arrived in Weimar. He became editor of Nietzsche's works. Later on, I came into serious conflict with Elisabeth Förster Nietzsche. At the time, she had aroused great sympathy in me because of her multifaceted and charming personality. That conflict caused me terrible pain. Our disagreement arose as a result of complicated circumstances and led to the necessity of defending myself against accusations. I know it was all necessary, but consequently the wonderful hours I was privileged to spend at the Nietzsche Archives in Naumburg and Weimar are veiled in those bitter memories. Nevertheless, I am grateful to Frau Förster Nietzsche for taking me to see Friedrich Nietzsche on the first of many visits I was privileged to make to her home. The mentally darkened Nietzsche was lying on a couch. His exceptionally beautiful forehead was that of a thinker and an artist. It was early afternoon. His eyes, though dying, were still ensouled. They received the picture of the surroundings, but it no longer reached his mind. One was present there, but Nietzsche was unaware of it. Observing his countenance, permeated with spirit, one could believe it belonged to someone who had spent all morning engaged in thought and now wished to rest a while. The inner shock I experienced led to what I can describe only as insight into the genius of Nietzsche, whose gaze did not see, though directed toward me. The very passivity of this gaze rested upon me for a long time, and it released my inner comprehension through the power of my sight that met no response. In inner perception I saw Nietzsche's soul hovering above his head. It was infinitely beautiful in its spiritual light, freely surrendering to the spirit worlds it had longed for so much, but had been unable to find before illness clouded his mind. The soul was still fettered to that body, which had known the soul only when filled with yearning. Nietzsche's soul was still there, but it held the body together only from outside, the body in which it had met such strong resistance in developing its spiritual powers. I had read the Nietzsche who wrote. Now I saw the Nietzsche who carried ideas from far distant spirit realms, ideas that even here shined with beauty, though they had lost their original radiance along the way. His soul had brought golden riches of great spirituality from former lives on earth, but it was unable to let them shine fully in the present life. I admired Nietzsche's writing. Now I saw a bright, radiant image behind what I greatly admired. I could express only in clumsy words what I saw. This awkwardness became my book, titled Friedrich Nietzsche, Fighter for Freedom. That book remains no more than such clumsiness, concealing the fact that it was inspired by Nietzsche himself. Frau Förster Nietzsche asked me to arrange Nietzsche's library. This gave me the opportunity to spend several weeks in the Nietzsche archives at Naumburg. In turn, this led to closer friendship with Fritz Kögel. Arranging the books Nietzsche had studied was a wonderful task. His spirit lived in the impressions of those books. A volume of Emerson was filled with marginal comments and showed his devoted study. The same was true of Guyau's writings. There were books that had passionate criticisms by him in the margin. A great number of comments in the margins revealed the seeds of Nietzsche's ideas. The end of chapter 40. And that is the end of this section of the reading.